Welcome to Legal Talk, a monthly conversation about the American legal system with Minnesota Supreme Court Associate Justice Gordon Moore. Good morning, Justice Moore.
Good morning, Rich. How are you?
I'm doing well. How are you?
Doing great.
Happy summer to you, sir.
Yes, happy July.
I hope you are, you know, I always feel like you guys should actually be sort of in recess right now, the Supreme Court, but you, the state of Minnesota Supreme Court, you kind of never are in recess, are you?
No, at the end of the June term, the United States Supreme Court literally certifies to Congress that all cases that were submitted for argument in that October term, I guess that would have been 2022, have been resolved. And that ends the term. They literally rise, as they say, and they leave Washington, going to cabins, to, you know, educational trips, things like that. Our court is a little different. Our last case was heard on Monday, the 10th of July. That was actually unusual to have a case in July. Generally, our last formal sitting is in June.
Mm-hmm.
And our term commences in August with the arrival of the new law clerks, and then our first argument in the fall is after Labor Day. But we don't just leave. I mean, there is some time for vacations, a little bit, mm-hmm. but we are trying to get cases done. We don't have to have them all completed, and won't have them completed by the end of the term in July, but we're trying hard to get as many done as possible. Right. So yes, we're very much at work.
They just work you guys like to the bone, don't they?
I don't know about that. When I look at our caseload and case numbers compared to what my colleagues in district court are dealing with, I mean, obviously they're different things.
Yeah.
But, you know, it's kind of ridiculous. I looked this morning at the number of opinions that I'll be writing this mm-hmm. year, and it's around 15 or something.
Okay.
I mean, and of course those are deeper dives for the most part. But I think of an average calendar that I had, even in Nobles County, on a busy Monday or Tuesday,
mm-hmm.
and it was not unusual to have 30 to 40 cases to deal with,
wow.
if not more. And obviously, some of those were in and out, no opinion being issued. So it's not like you're writing
right.
opinions or orders in every case, but just the volume and the type of work is so different.
Real quick, we're on a little bit of a timeline today, but did you have to write an opinion for every case that came before you, every case that you...
In the district court?
Yeah.
No,
yeah.
What would typically happen is, because of the way that our court system has evolved into mm-hmm. e-court, usually court administration or my trusty court reporter would prepare generally a basic order after most hearings, mm-hmm. memorializing what happened, and usually it involves setting a new hearing date.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot of times it was, frankly, kind of form orders that were being filled in,
sure.
you know, scheduling orders, sentencing orders, those things. You wrote individual orders on cases that were taken under advisement at the district court, meaning
okay.
that, you know, research had to be done and writing. And so when you were doing that, you would have to formally announce to the parties, I'm taking this under advisement and I will issue a decision within the timelines. And I would say there were maybe one or two of those a week. It's a little hard to know in the district court. I mean, I had some years where it seemed like it was more than that, but
mm-hmm.
how it all evened out. And not every under advisement order is a, you know, lengthy one.
Yeah.
I had a bit of a habit of, you know, complicating things in district court. My clerks used to tell me that there was no Judge Moore order that was less than 10 pages, but
that's
not exactly true, but there were some that were. In any event, it's just a different, the appellate work, the type of work we're doing is so different than the trial court work,
yeah.
but both are important to our court system.
Right. Okay, so things are sort of wrapped up now. Is that
wrapped
right?
up as far as oral arguments go. We've got work to do on getting
yes.
opinions out.
Yeah, and that's just going to, but that with the Supreme Court, state Supreme Court, that's just ongoing.
It
right?
is. That's a year-round process.
Yeah.
Some cases just take longer.
Yeah.
And people wonder sometimes when they see the decision, boy, that took a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And what they don't know is what went into getting that.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't share that, but I can assure you that nobody is just sitting on things there. There's a lot of behind-the-scenes work
right.
that's done. And frankly, a lot of times it's to try to find a way for the court to get to a consensus or a unanimous agreement on something. Because, you know, oftentimes we feel like there are certain kinds of cases where we really should be speaking with one voice and not two or three.
Mm-hmm.
And so we work hard at trying to get there. And that can mean some interesting shifts and flips regarding how the writing's going. And
I can imagine that takes a lot of conversation.
Well, it does. And it's frankly sometimes a little frustrating from me coming from a district court standpoint where it was just myself.
Yeah.
I mean, if I had laid orders, that was on me. Mm-hmm. That was not on my colleagues. But, you know, when we're talking in an appellate context, sometimes you're waiting on a colleague to respond to a writing. Sometimes, you know, and there's more layers of review, which is important because, frankly, I look back at some of my district court orders and I think, oh my gosh, how did that get out? Well, the reality is it had to get out.
Right.
You know, I didn't have 2 more days and 4 more editors to look at orders at the district court. It had to be done.
Yeah.
And the Supreme Court, we work really hard to avoid errors or avoid the need for a correction of an opinion.
Yeah.
We're not perfect. We've had a few this term where we've had to correct a few things that people have brought to our attention. But for the most part, we have a process that involves site checking and review by a number of people before the finished product hits the newsstand on Wednesday mornings at 10.
Okay. All right. So you're going to keep working on your opinions. You've got you're going to say goodbye to your clerks, and you're going to get new ones.
Got new ones coming in. New crew comes in August 1st. It's a changing of the guard. It's literally an overnight thing. The old folks leave at 5 o'clock or maybe a little earlier on the last day of school, as we call it.
Yep.
But on July 31st, they're out of there that afternoon, and then our trusty judicial assistants and the maintenance people are literally cleaning and organizing and preparing offices for the new crew to come in, and they do. And they have a lot of orientation and sort of a school session. So they're not thrown into the deep end of the pool too quickly, but it happens pretty fast.
Typically, when you end a law clerkship, where do your clerks go from here?
The majority of, the majority of them end up taking a trip. I mean, it's kind of like they just want to get out of Dodge for a while. It's a little bit like a medical residency.
Yeah.
It's pretty intense. And for the last couple months, it's very intense. There's a lot of work. They're feeling the pressure. They have to write transition memos for their successor clerks. And so the less they have, the less that's undone, the less they have to talk about.
Yeah.
And so they are pushing us. We are pushing the clerks to try to get stuff out the door or at least into the pipeline far enough that when the new crew comes on, there's maybe details, but not substantive work.
Sure.
So a lot of them end up taking trips. They want to go someplace, international, domestic, camping, and usually they're starting jobs in the fall.
Okay.
I always encourage my clerks if they can, take some time off when they don't have stuff on their plate. If they could just have a clean plate for a few months, there's so little time for that in life. And once they get involved in a law practice, there's no clean plate.
Right.
And so they generally will take from August through, September into October for travel or for just, family. Mm-hmm. And then a lot of them start work in the fall. I'd say the majority of them are going to be in some law firm capacity.
Mm-hmm.
Mostly bigger firms in the Twin Cities, but not everybody. We have some people that are going the public interest route or maybe are not 100% sure yet. And, I always encourage clerks to look at public interest work. It's not as lucrative, but it's really important.
Right. Do any of them by the time they're done clerking for you, they've got, 3 years of law school plus a year?
Yes.
Any of them think at that point, the law's not for me? I mean, does that happen very often?
Boy, by that point, I don't think so.
Yeah.
I think they're over halfway across the lake, so to speak. They're probably not turning back.
Right.
Some of them do end up doing another clerkship. We have got some that end up going doing a federal clerkship, either trial court or appellate court, or some have gone even to the district court to try something different. So, and some will end up in academia at some level that are interested in teaching. But, so, I mean, nobody these days seems to stay with the same job they start. I mean, those days of, you know, I joined the firm and 40 years later I retired.
I'm still here.
That's pretty unusual.
That's rare.
Some of them, I mean, they're just incredibly talented people. It would not shock me to see some of this group in a judge capacity someday.
Fantastic.
You know, and I always feel like these law clerks are sort of like children to some degree.
Mm-hmm.
You want them to do well. You know that they're going to have their bumps and ups and downs in life like we all do, and they're going to have professional disappointments and hopefully some success. And they're incredibly talented. We just hired for the 24-25 term, and the caliber of people that we get to choose from is just really unbelievable. I mean, we are so fortunate.
Well, you're the state Supreme Court. I would hope that you're getting
I would hope so too. Thanks to the work that our legislators did, the salary for law clerks has been increased dramatically.
That's
which
good.
I think is going to help, because, you know, as the result of something we'll talk about in a minute here, mm-hmm. student loans are going to be coming due this fall. And, you know, if you join a law firm, you might be able to get some help with that. But if you're working for the government as a law clerk, you know, you're kind of on your own there. But I really think that the legislative efforts at increasing pay for law clerks are going to help us. Mm-hmm. We've got work to do, particularly in the rural areas, to get people to consider working for trial court judges in rural areas, which they should. But overall, the Supreme Court is blessed.
Yeah, that's great.
We get the cream of the crop. And I'm not diminishing anybody anywhere, but we do pretty well.
Yeah, I would think you would. Okay, so one of the things that because we've got sort of a lull here, one of the things I think is a good idea to just sort of take a look at, not get too deep, because you can't offer opinions on any of this stuff, but it's, I think, you know, the Supreme Court, the United States Supreme Court has made all of their rulings for the year now.
Yes.
And there's some really interesting cases out there. Some fairly impactful rulings came down. And I think it would be good to hear from someone like you about what the Supreme Court has done here.
Yeah, we can talk about some of the key cases at a real high level. I want to emphasize to people that because it's possible that some aspects of some of these cases could become involved in state litigation, that I need to be careful to not be expressing any comments or opinions on how I would or wouldn't rule or consider something. So this is going to be very high level surface type of issues. But I agree with everything you said. These cases are really important with regard to so many factors of our society right now.
Yep.
And the Supreme Court, this court has indicated a willingness to review what I think a lot of people thought were settled precedents in certain area.
Mm-hmm.
So the law is really moving and evolving. Whether that's good or bad, I guess depends on the perspective and the case and the area of the law, frankly. But I'd say the court maybe surprised some people in a few areas and did not surprise people in other areas. That would be my assessment.
That's fair. If we might, then let's start with the affirmative action case, Students for Fair Admission versus University of North Carolina, and then a separate one versus Harvard University.
Right. The court held the admissions programs at Harvard and North Carolina violated the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment because they had a racial component to consideration in evaluating students.
Yeah.
And so there's this Bakke decision from the 70s that was kind of the, you know, the affirmative action case on what can be considered or not. I think it's just important for people to understand that this is going to change the admission processes at schools, and it could have some effect even on corporate hiring decisions, efforts at, you know, diversity, equity, and inclusion, initiatives are going to be subject to scrutiny. Mm-hmm. I mean, strict scrutiny, frankly, under the 14th Amendment to the Constitution. Whether this is good or bad, I'm not going to express an opinion on, but it's going to be a change because holistically, schools have been allowed to consider race in admissions.
Right.
And, you know, right up the street here is Carleton College. Mm-hmm. That's, you know, one of the schools that has done so. And there's a real concern, I think, among some that this is going to really have a deleterious or a negative effect on the efforts at changing the composition of student bodies in a positive way to provide more opportunity. And now the next area of litigation is going to be this whole legacy admission thing where people are angry at schools that admit students because their parents or grandparents went to the school and maybe were donors. And so stay tuned on that. But schools right now are going to have to revamp admission to the extent that they've got race as an express consideration. I think the Chief Justice was clear to say that students are allowed to talk about adversity they've had in their lives. Mm-hmm. They can talk about things, barriers that they've overcome. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that's going to be prohibited. So look for some focus on that aspect, I think.
Sure. But affirmative action as we know it is done.
Affirmative action violates the equal protection clauses of the 14th Amendment if it has a component in it that it considers race to be a part of it. And
Says the Supreme Court of the United States.
Yes.
Yeah. Okay. It's unfortunate that we can't just sort of linger on these cases, but it is what it is. The second one I want to talk about is Moore versus Harper, which to me, there's sort of two different layers in this. There's the idea of the independent state legislature.
Right.
But really what this case was about was the way North Carolina had drawn its
districting plans.
Districts, yeah.
Right, and the question is, what authority do state legislatures have to set rules regarding federal elections? Do they have independent and exclusive authority, or are state legislatures subject to state court review and state constitutional directives regarding how federal elections are conducted, including districting plans? And so the question was whether the North Carolina Supreme Court could review the North Carolina legislature's congressional districting plans for compliance with North Carolina law.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, it was a gerrymandering challenge.
Yes.
And on a 6-3 ruling, the Supreme Court said the Federal Elections Clause, which is part of the Constitution, does not vest exclusive and independent authority in state legislatures to set those rules. And so, in other words, there is a role for state courts to review state legislative action compliance regarding federal election law. And, you know, this independent state legislature theory was really first floated to some degree in the infamous Bush versus Gore litigation in 2000 over the presidential election in the state of Florida. Listeners may remember that the Florida Supreme Court had stepped in and made some pretty important rulings regarding how votes were being counted regarding a federal presidential election.
Right.
And the SCOTUS stepped in and said, no, you can't do that.
Right.
And the independent state legislature theory wasn't a direct part of that holding, but there were elements of it that were referred to by members of the court at that time, suggesting that the Federal Elections Clause might vest exclusive authority in state legislatures, not state courts, to determine how federal elections are complied with in a state. And Bush versus Gore is one of those decisions that's kind of been put in a box up on a shelf for the last 20 years, saying, do not look at this, do not open it. Hasn't been cited, hasn't been relied on. I think some members of the court, frankly, just felt like it was a one-off type case, but now it's come out. And in this independent state legislature case, there's references to it.
Yeah.
Let's just say this, the most extreme version of the state independent state legislature theory was rejected. That's not to say there aren't vestiges of it that are on the periphery that could still materialize, but basically, I think the ruling was that there is a role for state courts to play in reviewing state legislative actions regarding federal elections, i.e. districting.
Yeah.
And so that was a 6-3 decision, very important decision.
Had that gone the other way, had the case held up, and that would have really affected Minnesota.
Well, it would have affected a lot of things, Rich, because, state legislative delegations that are controlled by one party would basically have unchecked ability to, frankly, do whatever they wanted to do regarding how elections were done.
Right.
And, you know, as part of the challenge to the 20 presidential election was this whole notion that state legislators could more or less ignore the popular vote and send electors to Washington for the counting of the electoral vote that basically constituted, you know, what they wanted to do.
Right.
And, you know, these 60 plus lawsuits that were filed by the losing candidate in that election were often decided by state courts rejecting some of these candidly extreme interpretations of law and what happened.
Yeah.
And, you know, I personally, from a standpoint here, I think this is just a very sane decision here. I think this is good for, I'll just say it, democracy.
Sure.
I think this is, you know, I mean, one party, and this goes both ways, by the way.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean, obviously Minnesota right now is, you know, the Democrats control the legislature.
Right.
But I think in many states, it's the Republicans that control the legislature. And so, you know, yeah, I mean, does a minority have any say over anything? I mean, you know,
and to the best of my knowledge, there is not, at the moment, there's not a split legislature in the country. Minnesota was the only split one.
Unfortunately, Rich, states seem to become more increasingly
polarized
one way or the other. Polarized. Yeah, it's either Colorado, Minnesota, or it's, you know, Iowa, you know, Florida. Alabama, Florida, you know, that's sad. I think that's really,
I do too,
that bad for democracy, frankly,
all the way around.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
That's my personal opinion. Yeah.
Okay. Moving on.
Yes.
303 Creative versus, is it Elenis?
Elenis. Yeah. This case is one of, I would say, this has attracted a lot of attention.
Well, there's been some version of this case floating out there for a long time. I mean, someone objecting to doing something for a same-sex marriage or
you know,
on religious grounds.
Yeah, it was the Masterpiece Cake Shop.
Yeah.
The Baker's case from a few terms ago, also Colorado. And in 303 Creative, the court held 6-3 that the First Amendment prohibits Colorado from forcing a website designer to create expressive design speaking messages with which the designer disagrees.
Mm-hmm.
And in this case, it was the theoretical creation of a same-sex marriage website.
Mm-hmm.
What I understand is that this particular designer had actually never created any wedding websites whatsoever and hadn't been asked to do a same-sex one, but wanted to get into the business.
Right. And my understanding is that she wanted to post something on the front page of her website, say, you know, same-sex couples need not apply.
Basically. And so this created a real split in the court. This is a 6-3 decision, but there are some really strong dissenting voices in this one, because this goes to the whole question of public accommodations and, you know, the equal treatment of people in the commercial world.
Right.
I mean, you know, and the ramifications on this are pretty dramatic potentially. You know, we stopped in this country in the 60s, thankfully, you know, prohibiting certain people from eating at certain restaurants or sleeping in certain hotels you know, public accommodations. The challenge here is the question of First Amendment expression. And that's where I think the court is really struggling to decide, you know, what is expressive. I mean, baking a cake, making a website versus, you know, selling a cappuccino. I don't know. I mean, I'd like to think that a lot of people think that what they're selling has some element of expression in it, but stay tuned. This is going to engender ongoing questions.
I think you're right. All right. We are really stretched for time. So I'm going to skip over a couple of cases I have on my notes. I want to go straight to the ICWA case, the Indigenous Citizens case, and that ruling, just because I was surprised by this ruling.
Yeah, that the Holland versus Brackeen, the court held 7-2 that in child custody proceedings governed by the Indian Child Welfare Act, the federal law that protects Indian children from being, you know, I guess without process, separated from families. The court affirmed the Fifth Circuit's conclusion that ICWA's constitutional, that it's consistent with Congress's Article I authority, and basically rejected the challenges to the ICWA legislation. big win for advocates for Indian children.
Yeah.
I mean, a very, again, tough issues, but really, really a important decision. I think there was a real concern that if ICWA was overturned, that progress that had been made in prohibiting Indian families from, you know, being put aside and kind of just, you know, children being taken away from Indian families and not being put with Indian custodians. It's really complex, and it's hard to talk about this on a sort of an overview level without saying that there's also there's a Minnesota law that is involved too with Indian children. But basically this preserves the status quo, which I think is viewed as being good for mm-hmm. Indian communities and mm-hmm. tribes.
It's what the tribes wanted.
Yeah, very much yeah. so. Very yeah. much so. Couple of other ones real quick, Rick, should we yeah. could just mention Biden versus Nebraska.
Yeah.
That's the debt case involving, you know, student loans. 6-3 ruling, the Secretary of Education does not have authority under the Higher Education Relief Opportunities for Students Act of 2003 to establish a student loan forgiveness program to cancel $430 billion in debt principal. So this was the whole major questions doctrine issue. The court has created this doctrine to say that when executive agencies have basically done what Congress didn't allow them to do expressly, that mm-hmm. that's subject to review by the court, and that was overturned, and that's a controversial decision.
You can't say anything about that, but I can say I was pretty disappointed because that decision cost my two daughters quite a bit of money.
Yeah, I've got three children all of loans too.
Yeah.
Although I tell you what, I've heard even in my own office some pushback from people that said, "Hey, hold it a second. I paid my loans back."
I get it.
And I, you know, on the other hand, there's a lot of debt that was forgiven during COVID. Let's just say federal loans, and so, you know, the Secretary of Education, according to Justice Kagan and others that were in dissent here, gave the Secretary of Education the ability to step in an emergency and make some decisions on things. And so the question is, you know, what type of deference to federal agencies is the court going to give? Right now, that's a real area of tension. And then finally, Groff versus DeJoy, Title VII requires an employer that denies a religious accommodation to show that the burden of granting the accommodation would result in substantial increased costs in relation to the business conduct. That's the postal worker that didn't want to work on Sundays mm-hmm. because of legitimate, sincere religious beliefs. Mm-hmm. This court has advanced religious-related plaintiffs mm-hmm. To the head of the line, frankly. And so that case continues that trend. There are a couple of interesting cases regarding the social media statute, the prohibition of liability for social media companies.
Yeah.
People sued Twitter and Google claiming that things that were posted on their websites had in one case, in Twitter, the Twitter case, aided and abetted ISIS in a terrorist attack on a nightclub in Istanbul. And the question is whether that lawsuit is cognizable. And mm-hmm. basically, it's the scope of liability for tech companies can face under this Section 230 law, which is really a controversial issue.
It's a really interesting decision. It's a really interesting question in my mind, too, because it's not black and white.
Yeah. You know. And then one case that I think people noted, Allen versus Milligan, the Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act was upheld by a 5-4 decision that was not necessarily anticipated. The plaintiffs challenging the state of Alabama's districting plan adopted for the 2022 congressional elections. The plaintiffs demonstrated a reasonable likelihood of success on that claim, that claim violated the Voting Rights Act with regard mm-hmm. to how minority voters were treated in the state of Alabama.
Mm-hmm.
This is important because it could require redistricting of congressional districts in a number of states. And with the Republicans having a 5-vote majority in the state or in the federal House right now, it could be a big deal. And so, you know, stay tuned on that. That one engendered some strong dissents from the other side. So, you know, SCOTUS was busy. Their numbers aren't high, but the impact of their cases is mm-hmm. extremely high.
Yep.
And so I think there's some speculation that people are hoping that maybe next term has a few less of these really hot button cases.
But there's a couple. There's a gun rights case coming up.
Yes.
But, yeah.
The gun case, and then the whole question of agency deference under this Chevron doctrine in terms of, that was a case from the 70s. How much deference should courts give to administrative agencies interpreting their own authority of regulatory agencies? It's this whole regulatory state concern. That's going to be before the court, too.
Wow. That's going to be interesting.
Yeah. Hopefully the justices can recharge batteries for a few months and come back. They start in October. Their first sitting is in October. Ours is in September. And I don't know what our case is. We haven't been told yet, but I'm sure they'll be interesting. There always are. I mean, always are things coming up the pipeline.
Right. Well, that just means, Justice Moore, that we're always going to have something to talk about.
Yeah. We will. And hopefully this fall we'll have news on who's going to be the Chief Justice of the court and our new colleague. We don't have any information on that yet. So we're hoping within the next 30 days or so, where maybe some of that will become more clear.
I've told you, I'm somebody who loves to watch the process of American government. So we're going to keep a good eye on this one.
Good. Thanks for having me in, Rich.
Thanks, Gordon. Folks, Justice Moore is on every third Monday of the month. So he will be back in August on Legal Talk. Thanks for listening.